This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the mind chamber where, in 28 minutes, you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, how is the war it started going for Russia? It's been 2 weeks since the almost unimaginable in the 21st century, a full-scale invasion of a European country, became a reality. Since then, the invading country has been sanctioned and ostracised, its free press muzzled, its protesters arrested, and as yet little progress, let alone victory. That's how it looks from the outside, but how is it looking from inside Russia, and how might that affect the next few terrible weeks? Step inside the briefing room, and together we'll find out. We'll begin with the war itself, where the invasion continues to destroy homes and lives. But can Vladimir Putin be confident in succeeding in his aims? Michael Clark is a visiting professor at Exeter University and former director of the Royal United Services Institute. Michael Clark, 2 weeks in, what do you understand Putin's war aims now to be?
I suspect his war aims still are what they were to begin with, which is to say that he's going for broke in Ukraine. We all wondered, and we thought that, well, maybe he would try and grab a piece of the Donbass more officially than he had it before, or maybe if he's really, really reckless, he might try and push a land bridge out between the Donbass and Crimea. But lo and behold, he's gone for broke. He's trying a complete invasion. And he's now in a situation militarily where he has to either carry on or accept almost complete failure.
Okay. Does success mean regime change and some form of a puppet government?
He has to get rid of the regime in Kiev because it will never compromise in the way that he wants. It certainly will never be a puppet regime.
For that to happen, does Kiev need to be taken?
Yes. Given that Kiev hasn't fallen, he hasn't been able to remove the government quickly, which is the initial intention. Kiev has had time to make itself into a fortress. And now he is facing the prospect of brutalizing one of the jewels in the crown of their own civilization.
Will the generals on the spot trying to take Kiev, will they be telling Putin that this is going to be a long attritional business?
Gerasimov, who's the chief of the defense staff, who'd be saying to him, look, Mr. Putin, if we want to take Kiev, we could surround Kiev and threaten it and see if that does any good, see if there's some sort of negotiation to get Zelensky out of it with his government. But that's probably not going to work now, because Zelensky is the hero of the world and, you know, Mr. President, you're not. We can try that, or we can take it, but we've got to move in on the suburbs. This is a city of 3 million people, and they've had time to build barricades and to actually dig very deep tank traps. So, yes, we can do it, but it'll require everything we've got. So we need replacements to deal with the Ukraine that we may well inherit if we can take Kiev over the next, let's say, month or 2 months.
If Putin were to ask his general why has the advance been so much slower than expected, and the generals were to answer truthfully, what would they be saying?
If they answered truthfully, they would say that our reforms of the army haven't gone very well. The fact is, we've said that we have a large modern army, but the part of it that's large isn't modern, and the part of it that's modern isn't large. The fact is, we've got a rather specialised army. Our elite forces are as good as anyone else's. Our equipment is pretty well as good as anyone else's. But we have a cultural problem in our army, if they were honest about it. There is deep corruption. And one of the reasons that our weapon systems are not performing very well is because these people thought they were on exercise in Western Russia and in Belarus. And when they're on exercise, they agree to all sorts of things that aren't really true. They tick the boxes for maintenance that aren't really there. And they sell their equipment because they're paid so little. And so the forces that have gone over the border actually are extremely unprepared. You can tell they're not battle ready because they didn't expect to be in a battle.
And what about morale?
Morale, we think, is fairly low. I mean, I think we ought to be careful about this because Western media tends to rebroadcast the stories that are the most human and the ones that they like. Russian professional soldiers, the hard-bitten soldiers, those who've been in Chechnya and Syria, they know what war feels like. But they are still 40% conscripts, and those conscripts only do about a year. They don't want to be there, and all the middle-class kids are not conscripts because their parents buy them out, and the next conscript period starts on April the 1st, and that'll be very interesting to see what that brings. So the conscripts' morale, we know, is not very good. Professional soldiers is variable, but there's a basic difference here. Russian professional soldiers are paid on average $500 a month equivalent. Ukrainian counterparts, professional soldiers, are paid $3,000 a month. And the Ukrainians have built up their forces since 2016, and they haven't gone for all the shiny equipment. They've learned the basics of communications, operations, intelligence, flexibility of command, whereas the Russians are locked into this top-down, very centralized system, which doesn't work very well.
And still in all, there's a lot more of them and they've got a lot more stuff. So I was wondering if there's any sign that there's a rethinking of the military strategy, and one wonders whether this is the beginning of a far more deliberate and attritional process whereby the attacker grinds down the defender slowly with all the damage to civilians that goes with that.
Yes, and that's one of the choices that President Putin will be looking at now. I mean, it was Stalin who said that when it comes to armies, quantity has a quality all of its own. Numbers eventually will count, and this offensive will probably grind forward, but it will take some time because I think they will be caught outside Odessa. I think they'll be caught in the suburbs of Kiev. And at some point, the Russians have got to either go north or south through the Dnieper River Valley to link up their northern and southern forces. And they'll be caught outside Dnipro. And Dnipro has said they'll turn it into another Stalingrad.
This is a really tricky question for an outsider to answer. But is it your expectation and belief that Putin is getting the truth from his advisers and his generals?
I don't think he's been getting the truth from his advisers. And we know that he's extremely angry with the FSB, who he thinks are misleading him.
The Russian Security Service.
Indeed. All his three security services, he thinks, are not giving him the truth. The problem is they haven't been gathering the truth themselves. But he cannot but be getting the truth at some point from his military, because he can see the map the way we can. And he's got to be asking, what on earth is happening? Why aren't you where you should have been after day three and day four? I mean, this whole operation was due to be well and truly finished by the 8th of March. And here we are on the 10th of March. They've only got through the first phase. And I can almost see him in my mind's eye railing inside the Kremlin in the way that previous dictators have railed, when they don't really understand that they've made such a monumental strategic error that nothing he can do now will put that right.
Michael Clark, so the war seems likely to grind on, but what about the economy which sustains that war and the nation waging it? More precisely, what impact are sanctions having on the Russian people? Sergei Guriev is the Director of Postgraduate Economy Studies at Sciences Po University in Paris. Until 2019, he was Chief Economist of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and before that, he was Chief Economic Advisor to the former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev and sat on supervisory boards of a number of Russian companies and banks. Sergei Guriev, all the talk of sanctions and so on can sound a bit abstract. Now, if I were an ordinary Russian, what would I be noticing that was changing in my economic life?
There is a huge impact. I think the best way to characterize what's happened is Russian economy and quality of life of an ordinary Russian moved back 30 years when Soviet Union was a country which was isolated from Western economy, from Western consumer goods and services, from Western technology. Before the war, Russia was a modern country. Today, Russians don't have access to Western goods. Russians don't have access to Western technology, Western services. But the biggest impact is, of course, devaluation of the ruble, which means much higher prices for food, medicine, all imported goods, and, of course, deposits. You can see that you cannot really withdraw deposits from the banks, especially currency deposits. Yesterday, Central Bank of Russia said, if you have more than $10,000 in your bank account, we'll pay you $10,000 in dollars, and the rest will pay you in rubles at official rate, which is below the market.
What you're saying is that quite a lot of the stuff they buy, they can't now buy. I presume that some of those things are not essential purchases, but some of them may be more important.
Yes, exactly. There are things where supply is disrupted. There are things where there are shortages and lines. And there are things which are still on sale, but twice as expensive. And when we talk about essential stuff, mostly we are talking about medicines. Regarding food, you have to switch from Western food or imported food in general to Russian food, and that exists. But regarding medicines, some Western drugs cannot be replaced, and some Russians just can't afford. So this is quickly becoming a human tragedy.
So what quite quickly happens is that poorer Russians lose out very quickly.
Absolutely. They don't have savings. They actually face the most essential problems. Middle class loses access to Apple Store and Google Pay. Middle class cannot watch Netflix anymore. Middle class loses their money in their bank accounts. That's a problem, but this is not essential. But what I just said about medical products, that is actually life-threatening in some cases.
Are there already, or are there likely to be, big travel restrictions within Russia itself?
Russian planes will soon stop flying. That's not happened yet. They stopped flying to Europe, but they still can fly within Russia. That will also change soon. Boeing and Airbus decided that they will stop providing parts, update software, and carry out maintenance of Boeings and Airbuses, which are the majority of Russian air fleet. So these planes, if you stick to international standards, will be grounded in 3 or 4 weeks. Now, Russian government may say within Russia, even without maintenance, Boeings and Airbuses will be able to fly. I'm not sure pilots will be happy to fly such planes. So Russia will be a much less airborne country very soon.
Are there job losses already happening or being anticipated?
Yes, there are major job losses because foreign companies voluntarily exit Russia. Companies such as McDonald's or Burger King employ 50 or 60,000 people each. We already have a couple of thousand companies which have exited. And when you adopt these things, you come up with a number which is about 1 million people who are now facing imminent job loss. So there are job losses in foreign companies. And then there are also stopped production in domestic companies. So, for example, a Russian car maker, AvtoVAZ, actually relies a lot on imported parts. The same is true for many, many companies around Russia. But this is yet impossible to calculate because the shock is so rapid and the exodus continues every day. So it's too early to judge how many jobs are being destroyed.
And most of this is down to sanctions, is it?
That is exactly true. Sanctions were unexpected, unprecedented, united, and worked really quickly.
Sergei, what will the government do to try and mitigate these losses?
In order to compensate Russians who suffered from this, Russian government will provide substantial fiscal support. But that's not going to be easy because Russian budget will be under huge, huge pressure, especially if European countries will follow the suit of the US and impose oil and gas embargo. Right now, it looks impossible, but everyday things that we thought yesterday were impossible now become a reality. And if Europe introduces oil embargo, US and Europe together may actually force a lot of other countries to join. And of course, the key is to what extent China will join them.
Now, we always talk about the oligarchs, but I imagine that separate from the oligarchs, there just is a significant business class in Russia. And it will have been a business class, I imagine, that was consulted in no way about this invasion. How will that business class be reacting now?
So these people are extremely unhappy, but they're also scared. Mr. Putin made very clear to them that if they try to jump ship, even just resign, not necessarily betray Mr. Putin, but still he would treat them as traitors, that may result in imprisonment or death. No, they were not consulted. One of the indications of that is 2 days before the war, Mr. Putin's own yacht, the name is Graceful, came back to Russia. None of oligarchs' yachts did. And that actually includes very close confidantes of Mr. Putin, such as Mr. Sechin, the head of Rosneft, and his former president, President Medvedev, who is now deputy chair of Security Council. So these yachts also are stuck and captured by the West now.
Sergei, when we come to write the history of this in the future, how much do you think what has happened in the economy will have been decisive in changing things in Russia?
Economic sanctions will eventually result in discontent that will be impossible to suppress by Mr. Putin. So history will probably write this chapter saying the economy was an essential part of the Russian-Ukrainian war.
Sergei Guriev, so what do we understand about the mood among the Russian people? How much do they know about events in Ukraine? And what do they believe lies behind the international response? And does it even matter what they believe? With me in the studio is Dr. Maxim Alyukov, fellow at King's College London, and joining us are Isabella Tabarovsky from the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute in the US, and assistant professor in comparative politics at University College London, Katerina Totichnaya. Maxim Alyukov, if I can start with you, what is the quality of polling information we're getting out of Russia?
Generally, it's not good. State-controlled pollsters, they use very manipulative wordings. They call, you know, war the special military operation. And in addition to that, people are afraid to participate in them.
Katerina, does that bear out what you've seen too?
I think it's worth noting that in the past few weeks, we have seen a number of polls being released from Russia. As Maxim says, some of them were indeed conducted by polling agencies close to the Kremlin. But we've seen since other polls from independent organizations. With all the caveats listed, these surveys do give us an understanding, even a sketchy and patchy one, of public opinion in Russia today.
Well, Maxim, allowing for the caveats about the polls, such polls as we do have, what are they telling us about support or lack of support for the war and how that breaks down demographically?
They definitely tell us that there are significant groups in society who support the invasion or who do not support the invasion. And the former is bigger, obviously. But still, in terms of demographic, you can see very interesting results. So basically, if you live in a big city, bigger than 1 million, if you do not watch television, if you're younger than 30, then only 10-20% of people like that support the invasion. So the majority of younger people living in big cities, they are firmly against the invasion. And of course, people who are older than 60 who watch television, who live in smaller cities, 70-80% of them support it.
Katerina, that's a very significant demographic divide.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this demographic divide has been fairly consistent in all of the surveys that we have seen being published over time. But it's also, I think, worth noting that different surveys, whether these are conducted online with a sample based in Moscow or over the phone with a nationally representative sample, do suggest that there is a declining trend in support for the military operation. However, this question is framed.
Really?
Absolutely.
Isabella Tabarovsky, let's move on from polls to the question of actual protests. What do we know about how widespread these have been and how many people and what kind of people have been involved?
So we know that at least 13,000 people have been detained for having participated in the anti-war protests. We know that protests have taken place in 140 cities around the country. And I think if you just look at the videos from the protests, we can see that it's really primarily young people, I would say, although you do see people of all generations. There was a video that kind of went viral of a really elderly lady who I think survived the blockade of Leningrad protesting the war. It's hard, I think, to estimate how many people have taken part in the protests, but the fact that 14,000 have been detained tells us a lot.
Katerina, what happens to the protesters once they're arrested?
It's important, I think, to draw listeners' attention to the consequences of participation in unauthorized, i.e. non-approved protest in Russia under any circumstances, let alone now. Participation in demonstrations is illegal and carries both administrative and criminal sanctions that may range from fines to imprisonment. In the last few weeks, what we have seen is an incredible crackdown on opposition protest in Russia. There is, I would say, unprecedented police brutality, not only in the way demonstrators are being arrested, but also in how they're being treated when apprehended in police stations. Very brutal treating altogether.
Maxim, do Russians who are not involved in the protests know that protests are happening? And if they do know about them, what do they think they know about them?
In big cities, again, I think the majority are aware. Yeah, so protests are not covered by state media at all. So it's been their strategy for the past decade. They just ignore them. For many people who are post this invasion, they're just scary. They know about sentences. They see videos of people brutally beaten. Yeah, so many people cannot and do not join because it's extremely dangerous.
Isabella Taborowski, let's talk about sources of information. And first, there's always been, even despite some crackdowns, an independent media in Russia. Is there still any there now?
Well, I'm afraid that right now there is probably really nothing left that can be easily and freely accessed. Some of the outlets have been shut down. Others have been blocked.
And let's be clear about something, Isabella. It's not just that media is closed down. It's actually that the laws have been brought in which make it impossible to say the things which are true.
That's exactly right. We've seen a really interesting dynamic over the last few days where some media were closed and some media chose to closed themselves because they realized that they couldn't function under the current laws. And I actually think it even includes some Western media bureaus that have withdrawn from Moscow, in part because they recognize that under the current laws, they can't possibly be speaking honestly to their readers. And if they break these laws, then their local staff will be in danger and will be harassed, etc.
Maxim, are people getting correct information from social media instead? Is social media still an active source of some truthful information?
Yes, there are many channels which spread more or less objective information, but there are many state-controlled channels and many channels of regime supporters, and they also spread fakes. And for people who are not really involved in politics and don't have proper expertise, it's difficult to distinguish between truth and false.
So in other words, it could be simply a matter of going to the source which you've already chosen to believe.
Yeah.
Maxim, this means, of course, that the vast bulk of information going out to Russians comes from state media or media that supports the government in some way or another. How are they explaining to people what's not going right in the war in Ukraine?
First of all, they portray this war as something legitimate. So it's basically a defensive reaction to wrong actions of Ukrainian government who has been, you know, committing genocide against Russian-speaking population. And they also blame NATO. They also portray this war as extremely effective. So they just take cities and they achieve their goals. And every day you have an update from the chief kind of press secretary of the army saying that we achieved our goals. And they portray Ukrainian army as, they say, that there are conscripts, they are under military orders, and they actually don't want to fight, and they surrender, and we don't blame them. But there are these Nazi far-right regiments, and they should be either killed or trialed. And yeah, so they say that they don't target civilians at all, so information and images of destruction is mostly absent. And recently they've been producing a lot of fakes. So they say that, you know, there are bioweapons produced by NATO in Ukrainian labs. And Ukraine had been trying to produce nuclear weapons, yeah.
So every day Russians are actually seeing some big wig general or military spokesperson saying, this is the situation, showing them a map, showing them the great successes.
At least on television, yes, it's been like this in the past few weeks.
Katerina,
this narrative, I should say, resonates well with people. In surveys we ran in August and December before the invasion, 3 in 4 Russians agreed that NATO is a threat and that it will try to weaken the country if Putin does not stand up to it. So the constant misinformation on Russian media makes narratives from the ground difficult for people to believe in and sometimes generates what psychologists call cognitive dissonance.
Are you saying, in effect, that a lot of Russian people want to believe what the state media says and want to believe that it's all going well for the reasons that the government gives?
People feel uncomfortable when they are confronted with information that contradicts their beliefs. And for this reason, they choose to consume information that is in line with their priors. So, yes, there is truth to that statement.
Do you think there is anything that the people in the West, an organization in the West and in other countries can do to alter the information environment that Russians live in? Or actually, are we powerless?
That is a difficult question, if I may say. I think keeping communications channels open and social media open for these alternative narratives to be heard is the first step. I don't think that, you know, blanket bans on communications, on social media will effectively have the intended effect.
Maxim, do you agree?
Yes. Actually, some Finnish newspapers started to translate all their articles about the war into Russian to let people know about the war in Russia because they don't have access to independent information. So it's important to keep some channels open.
Isabella, among the Russian people, what would it take to bring about change? I mean, we know that the levels of casualties taken in Afghanistan after the 1979 invasion led to quite significant and widespread protests. Do you imagine anything of the sort?
Well, look, this is a question that's often asked, and I know that people really want to hear a positive answer. And I have to say that it's very hard to say. It's very hard to know, because it's just as we were talking earlier, people are very much invested in the fiction that state television began selling them already in 2014. It's very hard for people to imagine that something that they have believed for 8 years is untrue. Today, when people across the divide talk to one another, one will say, well, you are brainwashed by the Putin propaganda, and the other will say, well, you're brainwashed by the Western propaganda. So I think that whatever happens, the propaganda will find a way to create and incorporate a new narrative that will fit the same model. So when the economic sanctions really hit, they will say, well, see, we warned you. This is the West. This is what the West is doing. It's trying to bring Russia to its knees. But I do think that the information about the dead can potentially be explosive.
Isabella, do you detect anything in the way in which the government is talking that suggests a sensitivity to this problem?
I definitely do. So just yesterday, I believe, the Russian government was actually forced to acknowledge that it is using regular army conscripts in the war. I think this is a really huge concession to the fact that there is a lot of information out there now that I think Ukrainians mostly put out, interviews with very, very young 18, 19, 20-year-old captives who it's just clear that they're conscripts, and it seems clear that they were tricked into signing contracts. Russian law actually prohibits using regular conscripts for these kinds of military operations. But I think the fact that they were forced to acknowledge it is very significant.
Katerina, do you think they're sensitive to this?
Absolutely. Funerals of friends, relatives and family people from the same village and cities will eventually construct a narrative that cannot be dismissed by Kremlin's propaganda. The Kremlin is aware of this. It is worried. We have already seen mothers of soldiers confronting regional governors, for example, you know, asking whether they're being lied to, what has happened to their sons. And that could indeed lead to a very explosive situation at home.
Isabella, that suggests that a cynicism that we might have over here, that it doesn't matter what the Russian people think, Putin will do what he wants anyway, may be misplaced, and that it actually does matter.
I think it does matter. I don't think he cares very much about what the liberal opposition thinks, which is why the recent wave of immigration that we've seen happen over the last few days, we believe that probably tens of thousands of people have had to leave. And I think that even people who protest don't necessarily matter to Putin. But I think it does matter to him what the majority that supports him, that he keeps in his bubble of that propaganda of believing that this war is about liberating Ukraine from the Nazis, et cetera, et cetera. I think the opinion of that majority does matter to him.
That was Izabela Taborovsky with Maxim Alyukov and Katerina Tatichnaya. My thanks to them and to Michael Clark and Sergei Guriev. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Ben Henderson and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by Neil Churchill and the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon, but if you enjoy it, you may find other episodes interesting. You can find all of them on BBC Sounds.
Death by Conspiracy, a new podcast from BBC Radio 4. Gary Matthews was an artist and photographer, a familiar sight on the streets of his hometown in Shropshire. But in the last few years, he was drawn to conspiracies. And when the pandemic hit, Gary, who was suspicious of experts, ignored the rules. When he died of COVID-19, his distraught family and friends were left searching for answers. I'm Mariana Spring, the BBC's specialist disinformation reporter, and I've been investigating what happened to Gary by delving into the conspiracy underbelly of the picturesque town of Shrewsbury. From BBC Radio 4, Death by Conspiracy, a new 10-part podcast series. Subscribe now on BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.